One of the striking guests at this week's State of the Union address was the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico. She was there, she said, to remind the president and the rest of the country that a lot of work still needs to be done to heal her community. We don't want to forget a story that's far from over for the people living it, so today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're checking back in with Jose Marti. He lives here, but he's originally from Puerto Rico. Hi, Jose.
Hi, Gina.
Last time we talked to you, right after the storm, you were getting your news and participating in the relief effort from afar, but you're just back from your first trip to Puerto Rico since the disaster. Can you talk to me about your first impressions, like when your plane landed, when you first arrived?
Yeah, and you know, it starts with the plane approaching the island for landing, and you can start just seeing from the air a bunch of blue tarps. So that's your first impression. Now, in contrast with the blue tarps, you can see a lot of green. So I was surprised by how fast nature is recovering.
Yeah. I remember that when we spoke before, one of the things that was really sort of tugging at you was thinking about the natural beauty of Puerto Rico. And particularly, I remember you were concerned about the rainforests.
And that is correct. So I was really concerned how it's going to look, right? Puerto Rico is so green, especially when you're flying from Kansas City in the wintertime. And I was saying to my wife, is it going to look like Kansas City, almost like, you know, dry? And it was really green. So from the air, you can see that nature is recovering pretty fast. But in contrast, I'm going to say the infrastructure is not at the same pace. El Yunque is still at this time closed for tourists, so you can't really drive up to the El Yunque rainforest. That's understandable. They want the trails to recover, and it's not safe for people to go through the rainforest at this time.
So, you know, how long had you been planning this trip?
We were actually planning this trip before Hurricane Maria. We were going to be there originally for a wedding, which we actually went to the wedding. But at the same time, we kind of changed the plans a little bit to help, especially my dad and some items we need to fix at the house because of Hurricane Maria.
What kinds of things needed fixing?
I'm going to say a lot of electrical items. For example, installing like a surge protector on the electrical panel, working on like an actual manual transfer switch so the whole house could be backed up by a generator in the future, something that we learned from Maria. And a lot of appliances are getting damaged by the surges of, you know, voltage.
Power coming back, people getting hooked up again.
Yeah, so especially in where my parents live, which is called Manatee, they got power restored, I'm going to say, relatively fast compared to other towns, 45 days.
So 45 days, relatively fast.
Yeah. You know, mentioning that, you still have around 40% of the island without power, what they call pockets. So every other town has pockets without power.
Where your family is, I'm curious, you know, you were saying that a lot of people do have power restored where your family is, but that they're having outages from people hooking up generators and things like that. You know, I heard about a new really kind of popular pop song in Puerto Rico that is based on the sound of a generator that is, I guess, just a sound of daily life in these communities now. And I'm curious, you know, like, talk to me about the generator and its role in life in Puerto Rico right now.
Well, I know it is a really annoying sound, but even if you're driving, so we were driving, you know, in the north, I'm going to say along the north coast of Puerto Rico through different neighborhoods taking pictures. And during daytime, you really don't know if they have power, but you can hear generators. So we're like, oh, this community here, they still don't have power, right? But you get to the bakery in the corner and they tell you, you know, we're running off a generator. And the first thing they tell you, you know, it's costing me this much in diesel to run this place, but we want to keep it open. So they have small businesses are having that, you know, burden of, you know, a lot of money, spending a lot of money for fuel, and they just want the power to be restored. That's their number one concern.
You know, when you anticipated what it would be like there, what were some of the questions and maybe even fears that were going through your mind?
So number one, is it going to be okay to drive around? Are we going to be able to get to all the places we want to go to? Is it going to be safe during daytime and nighttime? And is it our business going to be open? We really didn't know exactly the condition, specifically by area. So after going there, I would say San Juan and the metro area. On the surface, it seems like it's close to normality, right? Especially the old San Juan that you have cruise ships going in. We saw tourists around the old San Juan. But as you drive out of the metro area of San Juan, well, it's another, like the other face of Puerto Rico. Roads are pretty bad condition, especially it's been raining a lot and there's a lot of potholes. And really, you don't know how deep is that pothole is going to be if you're driving over. Stoplights are in pretty bad shape. Some of them don't even have, the stoplight signals up. And some of them, they have some confusing lights blinking at the same time, like yellow and green. And especially, I haven't been there since or before the hurricane. So I'm not used to how's the traffic pattern going to be. Are people stopping or not? So yeah, it is a little bit scary, especially if you're driving nighttime. But for the most part, the highways are in decent shape, not great. But as you go into the countryside and go into towns like, up, I'm gonna say the center of the island, Morovis, Utuado, Lares, it's another story over there.
You know, just thinking about things like navigating traffic, are there other little details of everyday life that are distinctly post-hurricane to you? Something you noticed because it was new to you that everyone else was just kind of accustomed to?
Well, I'm gonna say home department store, like I'm gonna say a brand like Home Depot, they're always full. So those stores are always full. People are doing their own repairs if they can. You hear a lot of, I'm gonna say bakeries, going to the bakery, getting your bread and your coffee. That is normal in Puerto Rico, but I'm gonna say going there to talk about what's happening, of the talking about the recovery. That seems to be normal over there. So it's, I don't know if it's like
It's
a
like
therapy session, but you could hear everyone talking about dealings with FEMA or dealings with their insurance company. So that was something for me that I could sit in a coffee shop drinking my coffee and just kind of over, listening to other people's conversations.
learning the newest with FEMA at the coffee
That
shop.
is the best Twitter out there.
You know, when we Speaking of communication, I mean, when we last spoke, communication was an issue. And because of social media, you knew things about the storm and its impact that your family back in Puerto Rico hadn't heard yet because just of different access to all of that stuff. Like they were basically off the grid. So you were in the position of delivering news to people who were there from afar. Is communication improving? Or is the bakery the way it's happening?
It seems that especially on the countryside, communication is not great. So even if some areas they have power, they probably don't have internet access. So it could be that the bakery is the best place for them to hear from others. Especially, so I didn't go all over the island with my limited time, but it is spotty. Like cell phone signal is going to be spotty. In Puerto Rico, so it's hard to get information or even, getting access to call anyone. So it could be really spotty and it gets worse, I guess I said again, as you drive away from San Juan. And that is, for example, in San Juan, we saw a lot of businesses open, but some of them would close if it starts raining because they still have a lot of issues of water leaking through ceilings or pipes that are clogged up. So that is a normal issue right now in Puerto Rico.
Just that it sounds like maybe flooding happens a little more easily based on the damage from these giant storms.
That is correct. Actually, a lot of the debris from trees went through, the sewer or stormwater systems. So every now and then, if you would get a flash flooding event, especially in the valleys with all the rain, and especially will make driving pretty bad. One lane could be closed, so everyone is just on the center or the middle lane.
You know, were there things that you weren't like moments that you experienced that you weren't prepared for emotionally, despite maybe, previous conversations with family or images on TV, just something that really caught you off guard?
Yeah, there were two instances. I'm gonna say the one that hit me the most. We were driving to Luquillo, and as we were getting close to Luquillo, there is a basketball court, and it was full of tents. I would say 10 to 12 tents out there, and there's actually people that are still living on a basketball court on tents, 4 months after Hurricane Maria. And yeah, that is really sad to see.
Was there anything that was surprising to you in how unchanged it was? I mean, something that was just exactly as you remember it?
I'm gonna say probably the spirit of the people. I don't know if infrastructure will looks the same, because it doesn't look the same, even if places are open to business for business. I was there the first weekend I was there. There was a festival. It
What
was called
kind of
San
festival?
Sebastian. It's called San Sebastian, or the San Sebastian Street Festival. And it's probably now the biggest festival they have. And people were out there to, I'm going to say, celebrate. Everyone, it seems like every other group had their own homemade t-shirt with a message. And for the most part, you could see messages about Maria.
Like what?
There were just funny messages about talking about Maria, almost like if Maria the hurricane was a person, and like they were just over and they're ready to, like they're okay. We're standing up. Puerto Rico is standing up, and they were just ready to celebrate. And there was probably in one of those days over 100,000 people in the old San Juan. Celebrating.
Did it do your heart good to be back, even though it sounds like, what you saw was disturbing in a lot of ways? And but hearing about it from afar had also been so hard. Was it good for you just to touch down and see it for yourself, or is it kind of haunting you?
It was really good to be there, and at the same time, the frustrations of family and friends who are there, they really get to you, because you could see how slow the recovery is going, especially on the electricity. And every day you hear, they just don't have materials, and you start wondering, how is this going to get any better? How long is it going to take for the different utility crews are out there trying to restore power, get materials. All that is really gets to you when you're there. You can see sometimes you're driving by places where you see the utility trucks, and some of them they don't seem to be doing much. So that really the frustration gets or get got me to a different level when you're actually there, and it's I'm gonna say what 4 months after.
Yeah.
So that is the biggest deal when you're there. You can touch the frustration. You're there with them, and especially on, we drove by, for example, the FEMA Disaster Recovery Center in Manatee. The parking lot is full. I'm guessing people still going in there for claims, almost like it was the day after Maria.
You know, what do you think is the role for people living in other parts of the US in contributing to the recovery? Is there something that the Puerto Ricans you talk to on your trip wish that we would do or just even understand about the situation?
I'm going to share not my comment, but the comment of a gentleman who was sitting right next to me in a bakery. And I'm guessing he was a native from a state, but he lived partially in Puerto Rico. And he was telling me, I was on the table right next to him, and he was telling me, I was here during Maria. I came back just a couple weeks ago. And this is not by any means acceptable in US and the mainland. And you come here and it's a different story 4 months after. So that wasn't the message of any Puerto Rican. That was, it's a US native or US citizen that live in the mainland who lived partially in Puerto Rico, and he was completely frustrated with the progress of the recovery.
Jose Marti, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Jose is on the board of the Puerto Rican Society of Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll be headed to the South Pole in search of extinct life forms that might have clues about what it takes to survive climate change. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now I'm here with Dr. Patty Ryberg. She's a Park University scientist who just returned from an expedition to Antarctica. She was on a quest to bring home fossils of plants that used to grow there. Hi, Patty.
Hello.
Okay, I want to hear everything about your trip to Antarctica, and we're going to get to that. But I need to understand these plants, because we do not usually picture lush green plant life when we picture Antarctica.
This is true. Well, you have to go 250 million years into the past, and Antarctica was actually covered in forests. And I would say, oh, it's like a pine forest, but there aren't any plants like these today.
So they don't grow anywhere now?
They don't grow anywhere, and there's nothing like them on the planet today. So I can't say, oh, it looked like this kind of tree, because there's nothing like them on the planet today.
But you do know what they looked like?
Yes, we have just about all the different parts of the plant. So we have the stem, and we have the leaves, and we have their reproductive structures. So we're able to sort of piece the puzzle back together. And we have kind of a lot of the pieces of the puzzle, but not the whole puzzle. This is why we go down to Antarctica, so we can get more pieces to the puzzle, so we can put it back together again.
Can you describe to the best of your ability what these plants looked like? I know you can't compare them to other things, but like, help us picture what plant life in Antarctica once looked like.
Well, there were ferns. Ferns have been around for a really long time.
That's really funny, because I've kind of been picturing ferns.
Yeah, well, they're a group of plants that are called seed ferns. So they basically produce their seeds on leaves. So if you've looked at the underside of a fern and they have all those brown dots on them, instead of those brown dots, if you could picture like sunflower seeds, that's sort of what the plants look like. So they had what looked like sunflower seeds growing on their actual leaves.
Are there other plants, though, that looked like crazy, like some kind of Dr. Seuss thing or something? No.
Dr. Seuss is kind of crazy. You'd have to narrow it down with the Dr. Seuss information. But I'd...
Yeah, not specifically that, but just something really like outside what we would think of as like standard plant life.
Well, if you go not in Antarctica, but Kansas City had some really weird things that reminds me of Dr. Seuss, where you have these big, tall things that then sort of divide into two pieces at the top, and they're all fuzzy looking because they have little leaves on them, but not really in Antarctica.
Well, let's stick with the plants in Antarctica.
Yeah.
How did you get interested in them, and why do they interest you?
Well, I got interested in fossils because I was on a field trip to find shark's teeth in Nebraska, and we found plant fossils instead. I'm like, this is so cool. I want to do this instead. And when I applied to graduate programs, the University of Kansas actually is the American place to study fossil plants. And when I heard about that, I'm like, oh, I want to know what did Antarctica look like? Because you think, when you hear about fossils, you think of dinosaurs. And we know there are dinosaurs that eat plants, but you don't think, what kind of plants are they eating? So when I thought about it, I'm like, oh, we have different kinds of plants out there, and they grew at the South Pole? How do plants do that? So now I kind of go in and say, what did these plants look like, and how do they grow at the South Pole? Because they were at the South Pole when they were alive.
So the South Pole was warmer then?
Yes, the Earth was coming out of an ice age, so it was warming up. And glaciers were actually retreating during this time period. And by the end of what's called the Permian period, there were no glaciers anywhere on the planet.
So you just went to look for fossil remains of these plants, in Antarctica. So now I want to hear all about this trip. How did you do it? Did first of all, like searching for plants and fossils in Antarctica, did you do like extreme hiking and stuff?
We didn't have to hike too much. We needed helicopters to actually take us there because we're up at the top of the mountains, which are on top of the glaciers in Antarctica. So the only way to get around is by airplane or by helicopter. So the helicopter would drop us off and we'd set up a remote camp. So we were camping out there. And then we would.
How cold was it? I know it was technically summer in Antarctica, but I feel like it was still probably very cold on top of a mountain, on top of a glacier.
It was probably between 0 and 30 degrees while we were down there. So some days it was actually warmer in Antarctica than it was in Kansas City. And
That's crazy.
our camps were really close to where the fossils are. So we would just walk to where we had an idea of where there would fossils would be because someone had been there 30 or 40 years ago. And since there are no plants and there's no soil or dirt in Antarctica, we don't have to go digging trying to find the fossils. Basically, we walk around and go, "Oh, here's a fossil," and then pick it up.
What is it like to be in a place like that? I mean, it sounds you're using words I know, like we're on top of a mountain, on top of a glacier, we're walking around, there's no dirt, but we're camping and it's cold and we're walking. I mean, it's actually though hard for me to imagine what it feels like to be on that kind of terrain.
Well, it's very lonely on that terrain because it's you and your group, and you realize how small you really are because you're standing and you can see for up to 50 or 60 miles in every direction. So you realize just how small you really are, and that you are in a place that only a handful of people have ever been, and you're collecting fossils that no human has ever actually collected before. But a lot of people compare it to like a Martian landscape. So if you've seen the movie The Martian and he's walking around that way, it's probably looks similar to what the movie was kind of like.
Did anything surprise you about the terrain and or about how you felt in it?
Well, this was my third trip down there, so any sort of expectations I had were pretty much met. But the first time I went down there, you don't realize when they say, "Oh yeah, we're going to go on a glacier," you don't realize just how big these glaciers really are. Because you see the glaciers in Alaska in all these pictures, you're like, "Okay, yeah, so it's a couple miles across." And then you get to these glaciers and they're ginormous. And you're like, "Oh, well, why don't I see them actually calving off into the sea?" Well, it's because you're hundreds of miles from the bottom of the glacier to the top of the glacier where we're actually working. So you don't realize just how big it is until you're actually there. When they say, "Oh, we're going to go to this locality and collect fossils here," you think, "Oh, so we're going to go to one little spot and we're all going to crowd around and we're going to pick up the fossils." Only to realize this locality is actually several square kilometers and the fossils could be anywhere in that area.
Going to go on a long walk.
Yes, there's lots of walking going on in Antarctica. So with the group, there was five of us, and then we would just sort of divide up across the landscape and look for fossils that way. So sometimes you were all by yourself. Like I would look up and look around, and there would be nobody. So you realize, "Oh, wow, it's just me."
I mean, is that scary at times, or the way you describe it sounds kind of exhilarating to tell you the truth.
It is. And we do have radio contact with each other. So it's not like you're alone because you can call on the radio and say, "Hey, where are you at?" And they can say, "Oh, yeah, I'm just around the corner." And you can go and find people. So you're not alone. But just hearing the wind blow, or sometimes the wind isn't even blowing and the silence is just incredible.
Have you had scary moments on these expeditions?
Not really. Sometimes the weather is kind of iffy,
What does that mean? Describe iffy weather in Antarctica.
well, we there are katabatic winds, so basically the wind is constantly blowing, and it can be between, well, for us it was around 30 knots, 30 to 40 knots, and just being in your tent, which is the nylon tents that you get when you're camping, and having it blow in the wind, you're like, I hope my tent doesn't blow away. Well, luckily none of our tents blown away, but I have heard stories of tents and camps being blown away by these katabatic winds.
It sounds like such an adventure.
It is. I mean, you think about going to Antarctica and it's like, oh yeah, I can go see the penguins. But you don't realize, oh, if you want to actually do research, you need to do a lot of training. So when we got down there, we had to go through crevasse rescue training because if someone fell in a hole, we'd have to be able to pull them out. We went through radio training so we would know how to communicate with any type of radio they had down there. We went through helicopter sling load training so we could help actually move our camps via the helicopters. And we had to do deep field training. So basically, you go out onto the ice shelf and you have to learn how to camp and put up your emergency tent and put up your emergency stove and all your emergency gear. So you have to know how to use the emergency gear.
This is not your this is not your standard academic job.
No, you don't think about it. But when you do your research, you're doing what you love to do. And certainly there might be aspects that you wouldn't enjoy too much about it. But if you love what you do, you get through any sort of issues that might arise. And you don't think about what all the researchers out there do when they actually go out into the field. So I was thinking about documentaries, and sure, you watch 50 minutes of a documentary, but how many hours worth of film do they have? Because they had to sit out in the jungle for hours on end to get 5 minutes of a video. And so if you love what you do, you just go and do it in any obstacles you learn to overcome.
You know, I'm curious about how long you had been studying these extinct fossilized plants before your first expedition to Antarctica to go looking for them.
I had been studying them for about 6 years. So I started research in 2004 and I went down in 2010.
What was it like seeing like a part of one for the first time?
It was amazing. I did a happy dance when I saw it because basically the first fossils I saw was like a leaf mat. So if you think of how leaves fall in the forest in the fall time and they're just covering the land, that's what I saw, but as a fossil. So seeing that was just like, oh my gosh, we found them. This is so amazing. And every time we find something new, it's the same experience. You kind of like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I can't believe it.
So on this expedition that you just returned from, did you find anything that has in some way, I mean, I know you still have to do some lab analysis, but that even your observations alone kind of like pique your curiosity or make you think about something maybe a little bit differently?
Well, we're getting the purpose of this trip was to get fossils on either side of the world's largest mass extinction. So between the Permian and the Triassic, up to 90% of all life on the planet went extinct. So we're trying to find out what happened to the plants that grew up to the mass extinction and how did the plants that returned after the mass extinction get there? And so
wait, let me clarify this to make sure I understand it right. Uh-huh. There was one weather-related, right? Climate-related mass extinction.
No.
No.
We're not exactly sure what caused this mass extinction.
Okay.
What's happening is we are coming out of an ice age into a greenhouse, and during this period, there is a mass extinction. So the plants I focus on are from before the mass extinction, and then KU, there's other researchers at KU that also focus on plants after the mass extinction. So the purpose of this trip was to find plants as close to that extinction event as possible, so we can find out what happened to one group of plants and how did this other group of plants get in there.
Huh. And
what we've seen is the forests, because it was covered in forests, were there pretty much up until this extinction event. And then the plants came back are completely different. And we've actually found more plants on this trip after the extinction event that we knew were down there. So we're actually getting a lot more diversity of what was growing in Antarctica after this mass extinction.
And so Do I understand right that the lab at KU is going to study these plants to figure out if they can teach us something about how life survives climate change?
Yes. So because we're coming out of an ice house into a greenhouse, we want to know how do plants actually grow when at the South Pole when you're coming out of an ice age and going into a greenhouse period. Because it's kind of similar to what may be happening today, because we are sort of in an ice house time period as our glaciers are retreating, and we may be moving into a greenhouse event. So how are plants going to grow at the North Pole or even at the South Pole if we do go into a greenhouse world? And we can hypothesize that and figure it out by studying these plants from the past, because the last time the Earth was covered in glaciers was 300 million years ago. So seeing how life is adapting to these global changes will help us figure out maybe how life will adapt to the global changes that are happening today.
There's something very hopeful about that.
Well, it all depends on your attitude toward life as well. I mean, plants have been around for 600 million years. They go extinct and they come into being, and plants, like they say in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. So the plants have adapted to the different environments we've had throughout history, and as the climate continues to change, the plants will continue to adapt and figure out ways to grow in environments that we don't have on the planet today.
Where are the fossils that you collected right now? Are they still traveling back here?
Actually, I think they're still in Antarctica. The way this works is we bring the fossils to the main American base, and then they'll be put on a ship, and then the ship will actually bring them from Antarctica all the way to Los Angeles, and then they'll be shipped from Los Angeles to Lawrence. And so we probably won't see them again until about May.
As far as like work, I mean, the logistics of doing work in Antarctica, you've talked about this a little bit, but what else? I mean, it's not like you're just going there to do some sort of daredevil expedition. You're trying to like get work done. And you've already talked about you're sleeping in nylon tents and you've got crazy winds and you're helicoptering from one place to another. It seems like when you're in that environment trying to be a scientist, that would come with some unusual, I don't know, logistical challenges.
Well, the great thing about working through Antarctica is if you're going to do research there through the American bases, you need to apply for a research grant through the National Science Foundation. And that's where we receive funding to go down there. And then they have contracts for support staff. So when you go down there, basically, there are people there to make sure that you can succeed at your science. So you don't have to worry about, oh no, the helicopter's not working today. What are you going to do? There's people down there to take care of that. Like if you think about, okay, we need to get electricity going. We need someone to work the radios. We need someone to cook food for everyone. We need someone to take care of the trash. They actually have this support system in place in Antarctica because they want you to succeed at your research. And so people go down there to work to make sure that the research gets done rather than having to say, okay, well, we have to pick up trash today.
What is your favorite thing about Antarctica? I mean, as someone who's gone back three times to a place that, as you've mentioned, like very few people on the planet have ever been there.
It's finding the fossils in the actual rocks. Because you're walking around and everything is rocks, but then all of a sudden you see, wait a second, those aren't like everything else around it. Those actually have fossils in it. And no one has ever seen these before in the entire history of, in 260 million years, nothing has seen these fossils. So finding them and then knowing there could be something brand new that has never been known in these fossils. And that you're the first one that gets to see it and talk about it is just fascinating. And going down there and finding these things is what sort of keeps me wanting to go back.
Do you have a favorite discovery?
Well, this last time, for me, I like to find the reproductive structures of this Glossopteran plant that doesn't look like anything today. And we actually found a new one this time. So finding a new one was really exciting. And then we found new seeds. So I like to work with the seeds as well. So knowing that, oh, these have never been described and these are brand new. So now we have more pieces to the puzzle.
What do you do with the seeds?
We will actually, they're preserved down to the cellular level. So I can actually study their internal anatomy and how their cells were actually arranged. And so you can actually compare it to other seeds that are out there and to other seeds in the group. So now we can figure out, okay, it isn't one type of plant that covered the entire southern hemisphere, even though the leaves make it look that way. There's actually dozens of different types of plants that just happen to have leaves that look very similar.
This might be a silly question, but when you find the seed for an extinct plant, would you technically have the ability to grow that plant?
There's no DNA or genetic
It's
material
just the
left.
imprint.
Yeah, well, it's actually the cell wall. So you have the exterior wall of the cell, but everything that's in it, the organelles in the nucleus, are no longer there. So you can't grow it that way. It's basically a shell of a cell that's left behind.
Do you ever miss Antarctica?
Well, I've only been back a couple weeks, so I haven't missed it yet. But every now and again, it's like, oh, I wish we could go down and find these things again. Or this last time, there was a couple of localities we had wished we'd gone back to. So it's like, oh, I wish we could go there.
I'm just really struck by the fact that it's not that you've been to this extraordinary place, but it's still the work that you find the most magical.
Well, yeah, I mean, why would you go down there unless there was a purpose to going down there? And I've always liked putting puzzles together, and this is an amazing puzzle that there is no picture for. So finding new pieces to the puzzle to create this ecosystem is just what makes me want to continue to look at them and figure out what goes on in Antarctica and what did it look like 250 million years ago.
Dr. Patty Ryberg, Assistant Professor of Biology at Park University, thank you so much. What a cool story.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Just a little more show left this morning. Another local researcher getting attention, this time in The New Yorker. Find out why in a minute on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now a German professor at UMKC studies how people use language to describe and categorize colors. You might call it kind of a niche thing. So she was pretty surprised when someone writing an article in The New Yorker wanted to talk to her about her research and how it relates to Charles Darwin. We will find out why now. Tanya Kelly, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So, okay, when I say that you study how people use language to describe and categorize colors, can you explain that a little bit more?
Yes, before the advent of photography, people had to rely on words to describe what they were seeing in front of them, and especially scientists who went out on voyages of discovery and didn't have the ability to make pictures of what they were seeing. They made sketches, but mainly they relied on their descriptive power in words to relate this information in letters or in their journals to send back home.
And specifically, there are entire what are called nomenclature books attempting to categorize these colors.
Yeah, and that's what is caused a resurgence of interest in the color nomenclatures because Verner's nomenclature of color is being republished by the Smithsonian.
So wait, what is Verner's nomenclature of color?
It's a little booklet that came out in 1814, and it's available to see the original at the Linda Hall Library, which is where I found it and studied it. And it's used by naturalists to so that they can communicate one to another accurately about the colors that they see in minerals and animals and plants.
So, like what I might call sky blue, someone else might not, so that's not useful. I need to use like the official name of a color if I'm trying to communicate serious information to someone.
Well, at that time, that was the best option so that people could talk about, describe something and be sure that they're talking about the same thing. Now that is, of course, no longer relevant. So for instance, if I say a color such as RGB 34234, well, it doesn't conjure very much.
No, nothing.
Nothing. But if I say head of a goldfinch, and you can refer to this booklet, then you can go out and test it and say, well, yes, that is truly this color.
And the booklet does, it has sort of a frame of reference for every color, an animal, a vegetable, and a mineral that corresponds to the color?
Mm-hmm. Originally, Gottlob Werner wrote it about minerals and used minerals to try to describe fossils. But then Patrick Syme expanded this and added color names for the animal and plant kingdoms.
So why did this, how did this begin to interest you? What captivates you about how people use language to describe color?
You know how it is when you learn a new word for something and then suddenly you become aware of this thing in the world or this concept and begin to see it everywhere. It's not that it didn't exist before. It's that now that you have a word for this thing or concept, you become aware of it. And that is the benefit of language in sciences. Your former guest, Patty Ryberg, if she were not to have been able to describe the fossils that she saw and her experience in Antarctica, it would be much less compelling than just a data bank of quantified information. But since she was able to put it into words, she captivated us and pulled us in and made us want to imagine that, and it spurs on scientific discovery.
So you get contacted by the New Yorker out of the blue?
Yes. Like so many people, I think, oh, I'll upload this dissertation and I'll never hear any more about it, and oh, good, I can move on. But someone actually read it and wanted to talk about it a little bit more, specifically because of the book of Werner Syme's being republished.
And so the interest was in how Charles Darwin actually used this book.
That's right. He is, of course, the most famous user of the book, and he used it to describe colors of the sea when he was looking out from the Beagle. He described it as azure with a touch of Berlin blue, and animals and plants that his readers would never see, but he had to paint a picture for them in words.
Do you have a favorite color description of Darwin's?
Not of Darwin's, but there were other attempts to make these color nomenclature books. And one was by Obertour and Donathy. And they described a particular green that's in French, vert pré, but in English, verdant green. And it's so specific. It's the general tone of meadows or lawns, closely trimmed, observed in summer, from the height of a man at 4 meters from the feet and in diffuse light.
Can you picture this based on that description?
Definitely. And that is really the fun of taking one of these books out and saying, is this truly how this color is? Is a dogwood leaf really gray and not green? And going out and I would suggest doing it with your children and seeing it, is this really accurate? It wakes us back up to closely observing nature.
You know, I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the sometimes, I don't know, bizarre or maybe just a little bit eccentric color names in clothing catalogs?
Yes. I think my favorite in clothing catalogs is actually from a clothing, a fabric description from Paris in about 1905 that was called Burnt Opera House.
What color is that? I don't know. Well, gray?
Gray and brown, yes.
But a burnt opera house looks different from a burnt other thing?
According to this fabric manufacturer, yes.
So you study color and our descriptions and naming of color beyond the nomenclature book that you're like looking back at, clothing catalogs from Paris in previous time periods.
Well, I think that's more just a matter of interest. It figures only tangentially into academic research, but I am a painter too. And so even though I work in the academic setting, I have a natural inclination to look at color both from a practical standpoint and also how the manufacturers of synthetic colors, what they call them.
But why do you think we need to name colors? I mean,
well, we don't. It's you can peel off a little scrap of your paint from your house and take it to Home Depot and they can give you a near perfect match. So we don't really have to name them, but it is an aid to communication to be able to, and it helps us with associations and contextualization. And I think it's important psychologically to be able to name what we see around us.
Is there a color, have you ever had a color that you have been yourself just totally unable to describe?
Hey, well, I painted a room a color that is some people find hard to describe. I would call it close to Granny Apple Smith green, but other people have a different opinion.
The whole use of this in science, I mean, these books do pair the images of colors, you know, the paint, hand-painted swatches with like birds or rocks that have similar colors in them and kind of match them up. Why is that important to sort of connect it to natural objects?
Well, at that time it was important because scientists wanted to communicate with one another and compare specimens that were found in different places. And so if they could agree that this specific name refers to this specific color, and they had a guidebook to go by, then international scientific progress was assisted.
When you think back, I mean, when you think about someone like Darwin, do you think about his work and his experience maybe differently when you imagine him trying to describe colors?
Oh, I certainly do. I've taken a long adventurous trips myself with no cameras or other means and to communicate with people other than keeping a journal. And I think of Darwin and what he did to communicate back home.
And it inspires you?
Yes, it does.
Well, our time is up, but Tanya Kelly, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Gina.
Tanya is a professor of German at UMKC, and you can read about both her work and about Charles Darwin in a New Yorker article that came out this weekend. It's called The Book That Colored Charles Darwin's World. And that is a wrap. You can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier in the show, we checked in on the recovery in Puerto Rico and heard about an expedition to find fossilized plants in Antarctica. So listen back to both of those and this one at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, our first Friday arts show brings you a play, a gallery show, and a jazz orchestra. So don't miss that. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. You can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stick around.